Hello, everybody, and welcome back to KillerCast. All right, kids. So, as promised, I'm back this week with a two-part episode. It might be two parts. I might be able to fit it into one. I guess we'll just see how it happens, but this is like a big episode. So as I'm recording this, it is just past Mother's Day, so I do want to give a quick shout out to all the mothers in the world, because that is probably the toughest job out there, but y'all are doing the damn thing, and that is something to be proud of. Now the case we're talking about today has some heavy ties to a mother, but maybe not in the loving way that you guys would expect. Today's case is about none other than my favorite serial killer to talk about, and definitely one of the most interesting in my opinion, and that is Edmund Kemper, also known as the Co-Ed Killer. Now, this case is pretty gruesome. I do want to warn you guys about that. There's gonna be talks about, you know, obviously extreme acts of violence. He's a serial killer. Necrophilia is mentioned, rape. So just a couple warnings there. I just want to let you know before we start, because it is really disgusting. And with me saying he's interesting, please do not take that in any way, shape, or form of me saying that he's a good person. He is foul. He's disgusting. He did disgusting things, and I am by no means glorifying that. It's just interesting to kind of get a look into the mind of a serial killer, and you'll find out that Ed is pretty good for that. He is well known for doing a lot of interviews. He's well known for talking about the things that he did a lot. He definitely has a loud mouth, and he's not afraid to use it, and he's not afraid to talk about these things. So without further ado, let's dive in. So Edmund Emil Kemper III was born December 18th, 1948, to Clarnell Stage and Edmund Kemper II in Burbank, California. He is the middle child between his sisters Alan Lee Kemper and Susan Huey Kemper. There's not a super large amount to report for his early life until his parents' divorce in 1957, but it does seem like he had a better relationship with his father than his mother. Whenever his parents got divorced, he did, however, have to move to Montana with his mother and sisters when his dad abandoned them. Clarnell was an abusive alcoholic who would always belittle Ed. Many people speculate she may have had undiagnosed BPD or borderline personality disorder, and she would often lock Ed in the basement at night from the age of 8. She said that she was afraid that he would molest his sisters, so she'd keep him in the basement. And this basement was scary, y'all. Like, it only had one light in it. It had one way in or out, and that was a trap door under the family's kitchen table. So, again, Ed Kemper, terrible fucking person. Like, did terrible things, killed people, you know, bad. But it does make you kind of feel bad for, like, little 8-year-old Ed. Because, like, can you just imagine, like, a child being, like, locked in a scary basement all alone? I mean, I feel like no child deserves to go through that. You know, adult Ed, yeah, but baby Ed, I don't think that was necessary. So Clarnell would often degrade Ed, saying that he was too big and ugly and no woman would ever love him because of it. Ed did grow up to be 6'9" and somewhere between 250 and 300 pounds. But that doesn't mean that no one would love him, of course. Like, I mean, he was just a big guy. And she would often call him a, quote, real weirdo and say that he was just like his dad. She even claimed that the reason that she was mean to him was to prevent him from being gay. Which, like, you know, weird flex, but okay, I guess if that's what you want to believe, you know. I mean, you're wrong, but, I mean, go off, Clarnell. Sure. I'm sure that'll work. Anyway, though, Ed's father is actually quoted as saying, "Suicide missions in wartime and the atomic bomb testings were nothing compared to living with her," in regards to Clarnell. So, I mean, that kind of tells you what type of person she probably was. Ed's relationship with his sisters was definitely an interesting one. Ed would often cut the heads off their Barbies and perform rituals with them. He would force them to play games such as electric chair and gas chamber, where he would act out like being in the electric chair or a gas chamber, and he would pretend to die, and he would like scream and like flail all around. Pretty disturbing. However, Ed's sisters weren't completely innocent either. I did read in a couple sources that one of his sisters once tried to push him in front of a train and also tried to drown him. When he was young, Ed told one of his sisters that he had a crush on his teacher and wanted to kiss her, but that if he kissed her, he'd have to kill her first. You know, just normal sibling stuff. You know, it's just normal. So, when Ed was 10, he buried the family cat alive and waited for it to die. He then dug it back up, decapitated it, and put its head on a spike. He said he did this in retaliation to being kept in the basement, but that's not the only cat he killed. He also killed another family cat when he was 13, and this time it was because the cat liked his sister more than him. He put it in the closet after he killed it, and his mom ended up finding it. And actually, in regards to the stuff about like him putting the cat's head on a stake, like on a spike, whatever you want to call it, he is actually the serial killer that is known for the quote that says, "One side of me says I'd like to talk to her, date her. The other side of me says I wonder what her head would look like on a stick." So yeah, if you've ever heard that quote, that was Ed. And I feel like that's a little bit of just foreshadowing there, because he put the cat's head on a spike. So, yeah, you know. Totally normal. Totally normal. So I know that was all kind of, like, all over the place, but when it comes to Ed's childhood, a lot of it is, and it is kind of hard to put everything into chronological order, but it's important to talk about, so I wanted to make sure I covered it. Ed did a lot of talking, like I said, so whenever it came to, like, his childhood, there's a lot to be said about it, but it's all kind of, like, here and there, like, kind of hard to find the information, so. But moving on. At 14, Ed ran away to live with his dad in Los Angeles, but found that his father had remarried and now had a stepson. Ed wasn't mad because his relationship with his father had always been good, but soon things went awry when his dad told him that he couldn't stay there anymore and sent him to live with his grandparents in North Fork, California. Ed didn't like living with his grandma because she reminded him of his mother because they were both, quote, aggressive and matriarchal. Ed did, however, get along with his granddad because they bonded over guns and, I guess, like, quote-unquote manly shit. And Ed's granddad did actually have to take Ed's rifle away from him, however, because he was killing birds and small animals for no reason. Me being from Ohio, whenever I first read that, I was like, oh, lots of people do that. But I guess that's just like an Ohio thing. I mean, it's hunting, I guess. But yeah, I remember like being a kid and a lot of like the boys in school would always talk about like, even when we were really young, like, oh, the first rabbit they ever shot or the first bird they ever shot. So I didn't think that was that weird. And then I did some research and I was like, oh, okay, Ohio's just weird. So moving on. August 17th, 1964, Ed and his grandma got into it and Ed went and found his rifle that had been taken from him. His grandma had said he better not be going out to shoot the birds again. Instead, Ed shot his grandma once in the head and twice in the back. It was also found that he had stabbed her post-mortem. He then dragged her body into her bedroom and waited for his grandpa to get home. When he did, Ed met him at the end of the driveway and shot him in the face. After this, Ed panicked and called his mom. She told him to call the police, so he did. Ed is quoted as saying to the police that he, quote, just wanted to see what it felt like to kill grandma. Let's let that sink in for a second. Just wanted to see what it was like to kill grandma. That's very nice, Ed. It's terrible. He said the only reason he killed his grandpa is so that he wouldn't have to see his dead wife, which is holy shit, like, crazy. Imagine just being like, oh yeah, I just wanted to see how it felt to shoot grandma in the head, man. I don't know. I mean, what the fuck? And then just killing your grandpa because you're like, well, I killed grandma, so I might as well just do them both, you know? Just terrible. So Ed was taken into custody and court psychiatrists diagnosed him with paranoid schizophrenia, and he was sent to Atascadero State Hospital in the criminally insane unit. Several psychiatrists strongly disagreed with the court's diagnosis, and they later re-diagnosed him with passive-aggressive personality disorder. He was IQ tested twice at the state hospital, and the first time he tested as 136, and the second time as 145. So he was, like, super fucking smart. He was very intelligent, and he was described as a model prisoner and a good worker, which is not typical of a sociopath, which is exactly what Ed was. But, yeah, not typical of him, but that's how he was described. Ed was released on parole on his 21st birthday in 1969. Doctors said he should not live with his mom because of their rocky relationship and the effect it could have on Ed's mental health, but Ed still moved back in with her where she was now living in Santa Cruz, California. Now, I can't say much on this. I do think it was a bad idea for him to move in with his mom, but at the same time, you've been locked up since you were 14 and you're 21. It's not like you have all this money to just go get your own place. So he attended a community college and got a job with the Department of Transportation. He wanted to be a state trooper, but he was told that he was too big. Although he did befriend most of the cops, who commonly referred to him as Big Ed. And I've heard that, like, most of the cops liked him, like, he was friends with them. Unfortunately, living with his mom was a very bad idea, and their relationship did not get any better. They would argue over little things like Ed getting his teeth cleaned. So Ed ended up moving out with a friend in Alameda, I believe it is, but his mother would still call and visit. The same year he moved out, Ed was hit by a car while riding his motorcycle and got a $15,000 settlement. While unemployed from his injuries, Ed noticed a bunch of young girls and ladies hitchhiking in the area, and this is where things go sour. So Ed used his settlement money to buy a Ford Galaxy and basically built a murder kit in his trunk. This murder kit contained tools, a gun, a knife, and handcuffs. However, Ed actually, quote-unquote, innocently picked up about 150 hitchhikers before getting violent. He wanted to be sure about what he was doing and just never felt it was the right time. But then on that fateful day, May 7th, 1972, two students from Fresno State University named Mary Ann, I believe it's either Pesce or like something like that. It's P-E-S-C-E. I am not sure how to pronounce it. And Anita Mary Lachesa were hitchhiking to Stanford. Ed saw them and offered them a ride. They were both 18 years old. After an hour driving, the girls didn't know, but Ed had changed course and took the girls to a large secluded area in the woods. Ed had originally planned to rape the girls, but he said he felt weird about raping them and sexual contact with them made him feel embarrassed. At one point, his hand accidentally brushed up against Marianne's breast and he actually apologized to her. I would keep that in mind because it's really strange that he felt that way considering what all he's done to people. But yeah, I mean, total weirdo. I just feel like he's a serial killer and it's a little weird that he was like thrown off by accidentally brushing up against a woman's breast and like apologized. But anyway, it's said that in Atascadero, he learned to never leave witnesses, and that's why he did not just rape them. He stabbed and strangled both girls. He first killed Marianne because he said he thought Anita was more gullible. He had taken Marianne around the back of the car and killed her. When he went back to Anita, she asked why there was blood on his hands, and he said it was because Marianne had gotten smart with him, and he broke her nose and needed Anita's help. So he tells her to go to the trunk. As she was getting out of the car, Ed stabbed her with incredible force, but the knife didn't even go through her clothes. When Anita saw what was happening, she screamed and started fighting back. In the process of trying to slash her throat, he cut his own hand and didn't realize for over an hour. He kept stabbing her over and over, a few times so deep that he said he could see the bone and started to get scared when her screaming got louder. She slowly started to die and eventually had completely passed away. He put the girls' bodies in the trunk of his car and drove back to his apartment where his roommate was not home. He actually got pulled over by the police for a broken taillight on his way home, and the police, like, they were none the wiser. They had no idea what was in his trunk. They had no idea what he'd just done. Like, they just pulled him over and was like, hey, your taillight's broken. But little did they know what he had in his trunk. When he got home, he dragged the bodies to his room and took provocative and explicit photos of their bodies and raped them. He then dismembered them, and after committing irrematio, which is basically like forced fellatio, it's disgusting, and he did that to their decapitated heads. He disposed of their remains in plastic bags and dumped them near the Loma Prieta Mountain. Mary's skull was found on the mountain, but they were unable to locate the rest of her or any of Anita's remains. In September of 1972, Ed started to get the desire to kill again. September 14th, 1972, he picked up 15-year-old Aiko Ku, who was hitchhiking after missing the bus to her dance class. He picked her up along University Avenue in Berkeley, California, and she was heading to San Francisco. I'm going to let you guys know, I have a lot of information on this one. It seems like, at least from the research I've done, this is the one he's talked about most. And so I have a lot of time that we're going to spend here on Aiko Ku. So she was extremely nervous about being late for her dance class because it wasn't just some silly hobby to her. It was a big part of her life. Her mother was Lithuanian and worked herself to the bone to pay for Aiko's dance classes, and her father was Korean and she had never met him. So she was grateful for her mom's sacrifices, and that's another reason why she didn't want to be late. Aiko is not used to hitchhiking, but she really wants to make it to dance class, so she jumps into Kemper's car. Soon she starts to realize that he's changed course and isn't heading in the direction of San Francisco. She realizes what's happening and starts to cry and beg. Ed pulls out a .357 Magnum he'd borrowed from a friend and puts it against Aiko's ribcage. He tells her that he doesn't want to hurt her and that he just wants to talk to someone because he's actually thinking of killing himself. He takes her up Bonnie Doon Road and convinces her that he needs to tie her up and gag her. He tells her he wants to tie her up and take her to his house, and he finds a place to pull off away from the road, and this takes him to Smith Grade Road. He puts the gun under the front of the seat and steps out of the car. He tells Aiko to hand him medical tape from the glove box, so she does. In an interview, he said his hands were shaking, and she said to him, quote, "Now who's nervous?" and laughed at him. He covers her mouth and tells her to hop in the back seat. She goes back, and then he goes to walk around to the passenger side and realize that he has fucked up. He locked himself out of the car, and he thinks to himself that at this point he's dead. She can reach the gun, he's locked out, she's at an advantage. But then she does the unthinkable and unlocks the car door for him. And I can't even say that I blame her, because in a situation like that, like being 15 years old, I'm sure you would just have no idea what to do. But God, girl, I wish you would have just left that car locked and done your best to drive away. When she opens the door, he sits for a second, and then he lunges at her full force and puts all his weight on her. He tries to cover her nose and mouth to suffocate her, but she manages to grab him up by his balls and squeeze the hell out of him. Unfortunately, it didn't help her much, and before he let go of her, he strangled her. But she wasn't dead yet, and was still fighting. He strangles her again, and this time she loses consciousness, and he rapes her. He's quoted as saying it only took him 15 to 20 seconds to completely, like, do the whole process, to, like, completely rape her, which is just disgusting, but that's a quote by him, so I felt like I needed to put it in. After that, he then strangled her again with her own scarf and wrapped her in a sheet and shoved her in the trunk. On his way home, he stopped at a bar and opened the trunk before entering and after leaving the bar. He said, quote, both to check that she was really dead and also to savor my triumph, to admire my work and her beauty, a little like a fisherman happy with his catch. Gross. After leaving the bar, he went to his mom's house and talked to his mom for about a half an hour and then checked Aiko's body for a third time. He arrives at his apartment in Alameda about 11 p.m., and when he brings Aiko's body in, he goes through her belongings and is upset when he finds out that she wasn't the rich, snobby type. He decides he wants to go to a couple of psychiatrists to help him get his record wiped clean and to basically say that he's rehabilitated. And while he's at these appointments, he has Aiko's head in his trunk. Ed made a comment at one point about trying cannibalism, but later retracted his statement. I believe he was talking about Aiko when this statement was made, but he talked about how he, like, sliced off pieces of legs in somebody's back and fried them up and ate them, but he did take that statement back later on. But yeah, like I said, I had the most info on Aiko. It seems like she's the one that he did the most talking about, and so that's all I have for Aiko, but there was a lot to deal with her. So after Aiko's murder, Ed decides to move back in with his mother. And I know what you're thinking. Like, not your first choice. Wouldn't be the best option, but this is what Ed did. And on January 7th, 1973, Ed was driving around the Cabrillo College campus and had picked up three different girls that day. He let them go no problem, but then he picks up 18-year-old Cynthia, or Cindy Ann Shaw. She gets into the car and he drives her near Watsonville. This is where he forced her into the trunk of his car and then drove a little longer into a secluded area near Corralitos. He shot her with a .22 caliber pistol and put her body back into the trunk of the car and drove back to his mother's house, where he put her body in his closet. The next day, he took her out of the closet and sexually assaulted her corpse and then dismembered her in the bathtub. He then disposed of her body parts by supposedly dumping them off a cliff. However, he kept her head for the next couple days and would commit irrematio on it frequently. Disgusting. Like, fucking sick. He then took the head and buried it in the yard, being sure to place it face up and towards his mother's window. He says he did this because his mother, quote, always wanted people looking up after her. And after he had disposed of her body and everything, Ed took a trip to Oakland to see a friend and stopped in a laundromat. He took Cindy's clothes and put them in a high heat dryer, hoping they'd burn up. He put in four dimes and then he left. He said he returned the next day and the clothes were no longer there. The dryer was empty. After this, people had started to become suspicious that they might be dealing with a serial killer targeting hitchhikers. And rightfully so. So they recommended students to not accept rides from anyone unless they had a university sticker. But obviously, Ed's mother worked for the university, so he was unfortunately able to get his hands on one of those stickers. February 5th, 1973, Ed and his mother had gotten into a heated argument, so Ed told her he was going to the movies and would be back later. But he did not go to the movies. Instead, he went to the campus, and it was super rainy and there were a lot of hitchhikers. A perfect scenario for Ed, really. People would be desperate to get out of the rain and probably hop into any stranger's car. So Ed's driving along and stops to pick up 23-year-old linguistics and psych student Rosalind Thorpe. He said she was chatty and super friendly, and he also said he got something that he called Zapple. When she got in the car, he describes Zapple as the feeling he would get when he knew he was going to kill someone, and that meant everything was falling into place and he was going to make it happen. That just shows to me how sick he is to give, like, a cute little pet name for something so disgusting. I mean, I'm not, like, an expert, but I feel like that just definitely shows you how fucked up he was. So, just as he was trying to leave campus and take Rosalind somewhere, he spots another hitchhiker, which was 21-year-old Alice Liu. She gets into the back seat and Ed starts to drive away. Only a couple hundred feet down the road, he asks the girls if he can slow down to see the view of the city. This is when he pulls out his gun and he shoots Rosalind. He said as he was shooting her, he was thinking about what her brain might look like. Then he turns around and shoots Alice twice through her hands that were covering her mouth, but he missed her and shoots a third time straight into her temple. He said that he could hear her slowly dying in the back seat. However, they were still on campus, so this is where he starts to get ballsy. After he drives further out of the city, he turns Alice's head and shoots her point blank one last time. He pulls off the road and puts the bodies in his trunk wrapped in a blanket. He stops at a gas station to clean all the blood off of him, and then he goes home. He tells his mom that he fell asleep at the movies and he's going out to get cigarettes. He then takes his hunting knife to his trunk and decapitates the bodies just out in the open, like on his street. It was probably like 10 or 11 at night, but literally like just has his trunk open, casually cutting people's heads off in his trunk in his neighborhood. The next day, he brought their heads in and cleaned them and removed the bullets, and then he laid Alice's body on the bed and raped her. He was known for dissecting the people he'd kill, but he said by this point he didn't even care to. He dismembered the bodies the rest of the way and disposed of them in Eden Canyon. Ed later talks in interviews about why he would remove the heads and then proceed to violate them. This is a pretty disturbing quote, but I am going to quote it. He says, "The head trip fantasies were a bit like a trophy. You know, the head is where everything's at. The brain, eyes, mouth. That's the person. I remember being told as a kid, you cut the head off and the body dies. The body is nothing after the head is cut off. Well, that's not quite true. There's a lot left in the girl's body without the head." So obviously gross as fuck, but yeah, he said that shit. He really said that shit. So now this leads us up to April 20th. Ed was waiting for his mother's return. She had gone to a party and he wanted to wait up for her. He ended up falling asleep, but he woke up when he heard his mom come through the door. She quickly went into her bedroom and laid down because she wanted to read a book. Ed comes in to talk to her and she says, quote, "Oh, I suppose you're just going to want to sit up all night and talk now." And Ed responds with, "No, good night," and then left. He goes to his room, waits for Clarnell to fall asleep, goes back into Clarnell's room, and at this point, all his anger from his whole life had finally built up. This was the moment. Ed bludgeoned his own mother to death with a claw hammer while she was asleep, and then slit her throat with a knife and removed her head. He committed irrematio with his own mother's head, and then sat it up, used it as a dartboard, and screamed at it for hours. He cut out her tongue and larynx and put them in the garbage disposal, but they were too big to be broken down. He's quoted as saying that he did it because of how she talked to him and yelled at him throughout his life. He then raped his own mother's corpse and then put her in a closet. He proceeded to then go out for a drink and then come home and invite over his mother's best friend, Sarah. Of course, he then proceeded to murder her as well. And he did this to create an alibi that the two were together if they were to be reported missing, say that they went on a trip or something. He strangled her, cut her head off, and put her in the same closet as his mother. Ed then proceeded to steal Sarah's car and drive to Pueblo, Colorado. When he stopped, he found a phone booth and called the police to turn himself in. They didn't believe him, though. He later called back and spoke to an officer who knew him and confessed again. He waited in his car for them to come and arrest him, and he said he just felt like it was too much to handle and he was done with it, and that's why he turned himself in. After he was arrested, Ed was charged with 8 counts of first-degree murder. He confessed in detail, so he had to plead guilty by insanity at the very least, but the courts found him to be sane. Like I stated earlier, he did admit to cannibalism while under the truth serum, but later recanted the cannibalism confession. November 1st, Ed testified that he killed women because he wanted them as his possessions, and he argued that a sane person wouldn't be able to do these things. He said that he had 2 people living in his body, the normal one and the killer. He said when he would commit all these killings, it was almost like blacking out. At the end of it all, Ed was declared guilty on all counts, and when asked what his punishment should be, he told the judge that he feels he should be tortured to death. But that type of punishment was not allowed So instead, he received life in prison. He is still alive and is serving time in the California Medical Facility in Vacaville. He is considered a model prisoner to this day and is in charge of booking other inmates' appointments with psychiatrists, and he even narrates audiobooks and makes ceramics. In his time in prison, he shared a block with some other famous killers, such as Herbert Mullins and Charles Manson. Ed even tells a story about how people would get pissed off at Herbert for singing while they were trying to watch TV, and he said one day he threw water on him and he just shut up. And he said, quote, "When he was a good boy, I'd give him peanuts, and after that, Herbert would ask permission to sing." But anyway, that is the case of Ed Kemper. Obviously, a super interesting criminal, especially with his high IQ and his willingness to interview and talk about things. He's just really an interesting mind to look into, and you could go for days, and trust me, I have, just researching him, and you'll learn something new every time. Like, there's a lot of theories about why he killed. I know that he says that he killed because he wanted women as his possessions, but there's also a really big theory about him killing almost in a substitute for his mom. Like, he wanted to kill his mom, so he killed these women instead as, like, an outlet. And then that's why he finally confessed after killing his mom. But... you know, I guess that's all speculation. And, you know, I mean, he is a model prisoner, according to, like, standards. But he did actually cause the FBI to make a new policy for interviewing serial killers, which states that you have to have more than one person in. Because he was talking to this guy, and he noticed that the guy had pressed a button for help, like to get a guard to come, and the guard didn't come, and so Ed had noticed that this guy was like getting really nervous whenever like the button didn't work and the call hadn't been received, and he started like repeatedly like frantically pressing the button, and Ed told him to relax because they were just changing the shift. But then he smirked and said, quote, "If I went apeshit in here, you'd be in a lot of trouble, wouldn't you? I could screw your head off and place it on the table to greet the guard." So, of course, you know, that wasn't very cool of Ed to do. So the FBI had to put in a new policy basically stating that if you're going to interview a serial killer, you have to have more than one person there. So Ed has definitely... I don't want to say he's, like, changed things for the better, but in the way that I say it, I mean, he's, with him being so open and talking about everything that he's done and all that, he's like changed the way that we, he's like given us an insight to a serial killer's mind, and at least his. I mean, of course everyone's different, but it is really interesting to be able to hear him talk about these things and see his emotions while he talks about these things and all that. Like, there's a really famous interview he did in the 80s where he cries when he talks about killing his mother, and he's like, oh no, like, you know, I didn't just crawl out from under a rock like a lizard, like, that's my mother, like, I came out of her, and this is it now, like, I've killed her. And it's just interesting to see his emotions and all that. And a lot of people speculate that if he didn't go through so much abuse from his mother, he might have turned out a different person. I don't really know what my opinion is on that, but I definitely think that his mom was a total piece of shit to him growing up. I think that she was super abusive. There's no question about that. And I feel like Ed never really had a chance as a child and didn't have guidance, but that does not excuse anything that he's done. But anyway, y'all, that is the case. That's all I have for you guys today. It was a longer episode, but I think I'm going to keep it all one part. And yeah, that's all I have for you guys. If you guys have any questions, any recommendations, please feel free to send them in. Instagram or TikTok at KillerCast Podcast, or Twitter at KillerCast Pod. I'm really excited with how this podcast has been doing so far. We've been growing by listeners by the day, and we're in like 6 or 7 different countries now. It's so crazy because I'm not here to like toot my own horn or pat myself on the back, but I really just started doing this to kind of just do it as something fun. And the fact that so many people are actually listening, you know, it makes me happy. So I just wanted to thank you guys and also let you guys know that Wednesday is the new upload day. I have schoolwork due on Mondays, so Mondays were just getting a little too hard for me to do. So Wednesdays are the new day. I'm going to have to change the description and everything, but look forward to next Wednesday because we're going to have another case coming at you, and I will see you then. Bye.